Question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just
a second.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free of all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a weekly digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. Sitting in for Sonali Kohatkar, I'm Aura Bogado.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
Academics respond to the pro-Israel lobby and food sovereignty and participatory democracy in Venezuela.
Sorry if my eyes drop when the bello mellows out, but I can't help myself, why should I?
This is Uprising.
Welcome to Uprising. The week of October 22 through October 26 concluded what was deemed by right-wing organizers as Islamofascism Awareness Week. Organized by conservative pundit David Horowitz, the plea called for nationwide campus mobilizations and featured speakers such as Ann Coulter. The week targeted women's studies departments and campus centers for what organizers claim is their silence on the misogyny of Islam. Phyllis Bennis of Foreign Policy and Focus in Deconstructing Islamofascism Awareness Week pinpoints the objective in mobilizing Christian and Jewish Zionists. She cites the example of the newest pro-Israel lobby, Christians United for Israel, which decided in a conference over the summer to wholeheartedly back Islamofascism Awareness Week. Prior to the David Horowitz-led campaign, a group of scholars, Jews and non-Jews, came together on the campus of the University of Chicago for a conference titled In Defense of Academic Freedom. Though ideologically varied, participants converged and discussed the issue of U.S. universities as the last bastion for criticisms of the Israeli government. The following is a speech by conference participant Dr. Marin Laradi of the International Studies Program at DePaul University. Special thanks to Mansour Sabah of Global Voices for Justice for the recording.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. Those are the words of a song that Sweet Honey and the Rock performed here on this stage the last time I was in this chapel. What does it mean to believe in freedom so much that we cannot rest until it comes, to lose sleep over it, to let it infuse every day of our lives with urgency? Who are those who will take up the torch of academic freedom? What is it that makes us care that much about it? I think those of us who care most about academic freedom, those who are most likely to get mobilized to take action around it, are those who believe there is some specific truth that we're afraid is going to be smothered and suppressed and snuffed out. We know what truth that is. It's been talked a lot about today. But most often, it is some kind of truth about profound injustice that needs to be rectified. So many of us are here out of a deep conviction that if the truth about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is suppressed, the world is lost, that there will never be peace or justice in Israel and Palestine until it's possible to have an open public debate about Israeli government policies and actions and the relationship between the U.S. and Israel. So we're active in defending academic freedom because we care about a particular truth. Now, we do recognize that if we only defend the academic freedom of those with whom we agree, it may no longer be there when we need it ourselves. We do say with Voltaire, I may disagree with what you say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it. There's also a very strong argument for academic freedom, which is just that it gives us a chance to know the truth. The truth is an elusive beast. Most of what we think we know, we didn't experience directly. We heard it from other people. We read about it. Some of those other people read about it, you know, again, from someone else. We rely on other people's accounts. We hope these accounts are honest and faithful to what really happened. We compare evidence, we criticize, we synthesize, but fundamentally, we rely on the truthfulness of others. If the facts on which we base our views are false, we understand nothing. Garbage in, garbage out. So the worst danger is systematic attempts to distort or suppress the truth. The appropriate response to free speech is more free speech. If what we see instead is suppression of speech, attempts to prevent speakers from talking on campus, attempts to shut people up, then we should not only raise the alarm, but we should study this phenomenon. We should find out who are the people who are suppressing this free speech. We should not just call them the Israel lobby. We should find out what are the organizations, who are the people in those organizations, how many people do they represent, who funds them. That information is available. A lot of it is on the web. We need to enlighten ourselves about it. We need to shine a light on their activities. Is academic freedom alive on American campuses? Yes and no. I mean, the idea is there, but sometimes it seems to be not so much a torch like on the logo outside in the lobby, but it seems to be more of a flickering candle. If I think about the most important things I have read in my life, honestly, most of them were not written by faculty. On the contrary, it has been investigative reporters like Seymour Hersh, whistleblowers like Daniel Ellsberg, who gave us the Pentagon Papers, idealistic NGOs like Global Witness, which brought blood diamonds to the world's attention. Those are the ones who have most enlightened us. There are people like those who are speaking today who are very important and have taught us a lot of things. I'm just saying that there are many pressures in academic life to conform. It's not just the tenure process. Expressing views too distant from mainstream views means it's harder to publish, it's harder to get access to opportunities that lead to advancement, and opportunities that lead to more opportunities. My field is economics. It's certainly true in that field. Nevertheless, the university is an important place, but we could do much more in the university. There's far more room for active public debate. To some extent, you know, listening to the previous speakers, I think that an institution like Harvard or Columbia or NYU, at least in theory, you know, with rather large endowments, may be more resistant or potentially more resistant to outside pressure. But I think smaller universities with much smaller endowments may be less resistant to that pressure. Even where we have the formal right to academic freedom, as at DePaul, where it's written into the faculty handbook, we don't fully realize its benefits if we don't have both the motive and the means to stand up and actively defend it. To me, this means we need to go out of our way to get public debate going about the issues of our day. Now, we do have, you know, a number of controversial speakers at DePaul, but not enough, really, not enough debate. There's a student newspaper at DePaul, but people don't read it. You know, it's not a means for generating public debate there. And then there's this pall of fear that descended upon us after 9/11. It has to be lifted. We have to lift it. And so as faculty, we should be setting more of an example to students of open public discussion of important issues. Recently at DePaul, I really think it has been the other way around, as Evan made pretty clear. You know, students are setting an example for us, and I thank them for it from the bottom of my heart. Let me say a few words about my own case and then what I really wanted to say here today is, what have I learned from my experience at DePaul about why we defend academic freedom and how we defend academic freedom? But let me give you a few facts about the case first and about the leadership that did emerge to some extent. I came to the International Studies program at DePaul in fall 2004 with 3 years of credit toward tenure. I applied for tenure in fall 2006. I was supported unanimously by my program, unanimously by the College Personnel Committee, and the dean wrote a strong letter supporting my tenure. There was really nothing at all to indicate that there might be any problem at the next step. The University Board on Promotion and Tenure, which is the next step in the process, made its decision on May 11th not to recommend tenure for me. But I was not told about it until June 8th, almost a month later. A week after the decision was made, in about mid-May, the director of our program asked the administration what the decision had been and what the vote had been on the university board. He was denied this information, although the faculty handbook specifically mandates that he be given it and that he give it to me. On June 8th, both Norman and I got our letters denying tenure. In my case, everyone I talked to among the faculty was flabbergasted by the decision. The letter gave me hardly any explanation at all, a few words, vague, uninformative. So I met with the provost and his assistant to ask what happened. Why did they deny me tenure? What criteria did the board use? How did it apply them? I asked a lot of questions, and I got basically no answers at all, except a few details about the procedure that the board followed, but nothing about criteria, nothing about the reasons for the decision. I initiated a grievance to get some documents to which I believe the faculty handbook entitles me, documents that have been generated in the university board discussions. I asked members of the university board by email individually to help me get an explanation of what fault they found in the departmental and college reports. So far, I have found out absolutely nothing. No, nothing of substance about why I was denied tenure, and I have still not gotten hold of any of the documents. What does the university have to hide? This whole thing strongly suggests that this is all a pretext and that the real reason for denying me tenure was something else. If so, what was it? Was it my friendship and support for Norman? Was it what I said in a public event in which I asked Benny Morris critical questions about Israeli government policies? Was it some kind of prejudice against me on the part of the university board members? By all accounts, it's extremely rare that a candidate unanimously supported at both the department and college levels and by the dean is denied tenure. It's really extraordinary to do so without any sensible explanation, especially when another candidate, and that's Norman himself, who was denied tenure, was given a lengthy explanation. So, what happened to Norman and what happened to me caused many faculty to suspect that something strange and disturbing was going on. Really, up until June 8th, many faculty didn't think about it that way. You know, they knew that the dean had written a critical letter about Norman, but they sort of said to themselves, well, you know, the system works. The dean doesn't normally write a critical letter when the college personnel committee endorses a candidate, and so it's not going to be taken seriously at the higher levels. We'll just wait and see. And people waited and saw, and then they were surprised. So a few days after the tenure denials, in mid-June, close to 100 faculty showed up at meetings on each of two successive days. On June 13th, the university-wide faculty council met, and after intense discussion, passed a resolution that the appeal procedure in the faculty handbook was indeed available to challenge denial of tenure. This was a position that was contrary to what the provost was saying at that meeting. The next day, on June 14th, the faculty of the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences had a special meeting. After some extraordinary revelations and some impassioned speeches, that group unanimously resolved to establish a task force to investigate both of the tenure denial cases, Norman's and mine. That task force, called the Academic Freedom Task Force, began meeting in early August. I was going to say it's on the point of issuing its report. The report is being released to a password-protected website available to the DePaul community at this point. It's not being publicly released. And actually, I believe it was posted at 5 o'clock today. I filed a detailed appeal about a week ago. The review board that was appointed to hear my case has begun to consider it. I met with them yesterday. I did all this even though the president has said early in September and has not contradicted it since that he doesn't regard the appeal process as having any provision for actually reversing the denial of tenure. There are some questions about the fairness of the process, which I won't get into here. And there's also, of course, the question whether, even if it should decide in my favor, the administration will follow its recommendation. Naturally, I'm looking into other avenues for redress. I think I've learned a few things from this whole episode. Some of them are things I sort of knew before, but I know them better now. First of all, and I kind of hate to say this, but I was astonished to find that most people, including quite a lot of faculty, will listen to rumors, believe them, and pass them on without ever checking the facts. There are very few people who really consistently insist on getting the truth, who constantly ask questions, who exercise independent judgment. I have to say that among all the people I know, Norman Finkelstein is the most remarkably consistent in his pursuit of the truth, and I'm quite sure that's among the reasons that his students love his teaching. I'm just going to give you one example. I hope this is okay. I remember one particularly scurrilous letter written by one of his constant critics, making all sorts of false charges against him. And I remember someone saying to him, "Norman, look at this thing. It's nothing but a pack of lies. Not a word of it is true." And he said, "No, actually, there are a few things in it that are true." I don't know one person in 1,000 who would respond that way. I don't know one person in 1,000 who would read the words of his enemies so carefully and be willing to acknowledge elements of truth in what they say. So the first thing is, it's important to keep people grounded in facts, and it's important for everybody to challenge, you know, to ask for the facts and not just assume that what people tell you is true. Second, as we well know, especially from the whole Guantanamo situation, it's not enough to have legal rights, just as the right, such as the right to academic freedom. We have to have a way to defend those rights. I'm talking about written guarantees of a fair appeal process to challenge violation of academic freedom, but even that is not enough without an organized faculty that puts those rights front and center. You know, this is something that the American Association of University Professors has been insisting on. Honestly, I don't feel strongly about, I mean, appeal procedures, you know, have their value, and it's important to have strong, good appeal procedures. If you only have an appeal procedure that isn't strong and good, it's not necessarily that much of an advantage. Just organizing and setting up your own task force and raising hell is, you know, maybe a better way to go. Third, leadership matters. You know, people who are willing to take a stand and speak out and overcome fear and face danger and challenge authority, and to do so in a way that brings along as many supporters as possible, that's all too rare. People like that deserve our respect, our love, our support, and our constant appreciation. But we should not only support them, we should imitate them. I cannot begin to say how much I appreciate those who have stood up for academic freedom at DePaul. I'm not going to say their names today, but they know who they are. And among them, of course, are the wonderful students of the Academic Freedom Committee, who have been, frankly, much better organized, articulate, and effective than the faculty. I dare to hope that with our future in their hands, the world may actually become a better place. Among these also are the Academic Freedom Task Force that I mentioned in the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, who devoted a substantial part of their summer to investigating Norman's case and mine. Among them are also the members of the Sociology Department, who wrote a letter to the provost and who said to the provost, you know, Norman Finkelstein has resigned, but the problem is still there. What are we going to do about this climate of fear and uncertainty? How are you going to resolve that? And the provost went and talked to them, and apparently they're still not satisfied. I also learned that administrators are extraordinarily sensitive about a university's reputation, especially among alumni and parents, but also in the broader academic community and the community at large. Perhaps that's why the president of the University of St. Thomas has just decided to invite Desmond Tutu to speak there after initially vetoing the invitation. Or perhaps it was the pressure from the university's own law school faculty that did it. In any case, Father Deese should be congratulated for having the intelligence and good sense to make the right decision in the end. I think it's fair to say that the faculty at DePaul are not happy with the current situation. They're not sure what rights they have. They're not sure the rights that they do have can be effectively defended. This issue is far from over. There is, as one of the questioners said a little while ago, there is a certain atmosphere of fear, caution, timidity, uncertainty. And that's going to continue until some definite resolution is found. I have been told, by the way, that the president has appointed an academic freedom task force or something. I haven't heard the details yet, and I don't know who's on it, except for one person who told me about it. The terrible thing about fear is that unless we confront it, it burdens us forever. We confront it by doing the thing of which we are afraid. If I'm afraid to stand up and speak before a large crowd, I have to do it to lose my fear. If I'm afraid to hold a discussion of some sensitive topic in class, I have to do it, or I will be afraid to do it forever. If I'm afraid to defend someone who is being unjustly attacked because the attack may then be turned against me, I have to defend that person. We lose our freedoms if we do not use them. And so we who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. Thank you.
We've been listening to a speech by Dr. Mary Laradi of the International Studies Program at DePaul University. Special thanks to Mansoor Sabah of Global Voices for Justice for the recording. Coming up next, we'll be speaking with Miguel Angel Nunez about what farmers' knowledge and food sovereignty has to do with participatory democracy in Venezuela.
You're listening to Uprising on the web at uprisingradio.org. We'll be right back.
Arms are raised above the sky, but all I want is me.
Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Ara Bogado. Miguel Angel Nunez is an advisor to the Venezuelan Presidential Office on agro-environmental issues and the former coordinator of the Latin American Agroecological Movement. He was recently in the United States and sat down in our studios to talk about the food revolution as a part of Venezuela's evolving participatory democracy. Among other things, we discussed the Green Revolution and its legacies, farmers' knowledge and how it can be incorporated into new models, and biofuels. Nunez began by explaining his desire to make food an issue within Venezuela's current political process.
I'm coming from Venezuela, and I've been involved in the revolutionary food movement since 25 years ago. And now I am looking for a unique opportunity down in Venezuela because we are facing a revolution down there, and we want to put the food revolution from agroecological point of view in the Venezuelan revolution.
Now, within the agroecological point of view, that's oftentimes dominated by the quote-unquote scientific community, which a lot of times doesn't include farmers. It includes transnational companies that are able to dictate what they think is the best for the rest of the world in terms of eating and in terms of food and in terms of food politics. So let's talk a little bit about the social movement of the food revolution in Venezuela starting in the 1970s.
Well, like you say, you know, back in the 1960s and 70s, there was a race of the social movement looking for to have a better and alternative world. When we're talking about better and alternative world, we have to be in consideration all of the environmental pressure that we have, all of the social pressure that we are facing in different types of society. That one is, like a new type of paradigm that is looking to build a new society, okay? So, like you say, the transnational food company, they are dominating the way how feed the people. But besides that, we have in parallel a big movement, a peasant movement all around the world that keep resisting, and they keep showing and they keep saying us that is another possibility to grow food and has a new type of food change in the society. And that one linked with the agroecology. Agroecology is a science that has to study the past knowledge of the peasant and try to integrate it and try to relate it with the new knowledge in the agricultural science. We don't see food sovereignty working with transgenic food because that one is damage to the environment and damage to the health of the people. For us, the key and the true revolutionary process start with the food production. And many people know that one. And one is our main phase, I would say, to try to work in formation, sensibilization from ideological point of view, and try to explain, to try to understand the people that we must work to have an independent food process in each country. And that one is what we are looking for in Venezuela.
So how are some of the ways that these new paradigms, these new models are established in order to include indigenous practices, in order to include the voices of peasants who have been growing food for so long?
We don't have any recipe. We don't have any model. We don't have any truly idea on how you could be able to go. You have some point, some route, some thinking, some thought, you know, about how you could be able to approach in a social movement. And we are convinced that we are living in an environmental crisis right now. We'll be very highly irresponsible not to take in consideration that situation. And when we're talking about environmental crisis, we are talking about crisis of knowledge. The civilization right now has a knowledge crisis because we don't know how to deal with the environment, okay? And our environment is there. And how we're going to be working and how we're going to not only protect the environment, I mean to restore it, the environment, to try to see how we could be able to learn in different type of way and see how we could be able to put pieces, small pieces, and build the new paradigm. For example, in Venezuela, I would say that it's a few countries in all around the world. Down in the community, we're trying to work in participatory democracy. What does it mean by that? Okay, the community organized will have the opportunity to discuss their project, to discuss the planning, to discuss the activities that they want to do in the community. Besides that, they participate with the municipality building the budget of those projects. And also, in the end of the process, they will have the right to have a social control, Contraloría Social, about how do you spend the money, how do you do the project, how well, how productive, how effective, were you doing, you know, the same for the community? That one is participatory democracy. This is another type of democracy, and we are switching the paradigm because we want to put in the table the agenda of the people that are coming from the grassroots to the top. Okay, the same thing might happen with the agroecology and also with the sustainable agriculture among the social movement. For example, Via Campesina holds 60 million of farmers, 60 million of peasants. And many of those peasants are looking to work without any chemical, which means that we have something to work it out, which means that we have something that is in front of the transnational corporation of food. And that one is make the difference, you know. For example, we could be able to ask, okay, what kind of food production do you want for your country? What kind of food production do you want for your community? What kind of food production do you want for your municipality? You want a big, huge expenditure energy production system in the community? Or do you want a sound, environmental, productive system, agroecology, a healthy food with social co-responsibility, sharing the benefits, the social benefits, looking in that community with a different type of economical and social expressions? So when we are saying and answering you the question about which way could be the paradigm, there are several ways. For example, right now in Venezuela, we are discussing the constitutional reforms, and we are putting in the table the food sovereignty and the agroecological science to be in the Constitution. Why? Because we want that the Venezuelan population will know how the food that they are eating is produced, how it's being distributed, how it's being transformed, how it's being commercialized, and how it's being consumed. In other words, we want to know how is the whole chain of the productive system, in order to see that from the ideological point of view, we are working for a food sovereignty. Food sovereignty is not the same as food security. There is a big difference. Food security means food disponibility, that you could be able to buy food from any other country. Venezuela has been buying food, I would say, a few years ago we had the highest import food in the country around the world. We were importing 86% of the food that we ate. Right now, we are importing 56% of the food that we eat, and we want to lower that percentage. So that one is food security, because you could be able to buy, Venezuela has a lot of money, could be able to buy a lot of food and put in the storage and distribute to the people when the people need it. But when we are talking about food sovereignty, we are talking about self-sufficiency. We are talking about to have a production from sounds and environmental techniques. We are talking about participatory process. We are talking, like I told you before, to the social control. No, we are talking about participatory democracy. I mean, there are many things that are getting together and linking and giving a shape on how you could be able to overcome and how you could be able to work with the productive paradigm.
So I think a lot of people in the United States look to Venezuela for different examples, ways that democracy can be carried out differently. You're talking a lot about participatory democracy. You're specifically talking about this environmental crisis, and you're framing it as something that's a crisis of knowledge, right? And I think in the United States, the country in which the president here has just barely started to use the word global warming, I think the way that that comes down for people isn't really always very realistic. For poor communities, for working poor communities, for communities of color, a lot of times we don't consider the issues of food sustainability, of clean water. How do those conversations happen in Venezuela, and what do you think that we can learn from that? How do you get everyday people to really start thinking about food and land use, right, in a different way?
One way, you know, is to be involved in the discussion. For example, in the council community councils, that is already more than 20,000 community councils, they have been created the technique tables, and they have the opportunity to talk about water issue. You know, the community councils must deal with all of the route and how the water is coming to the community. If there is something in that route that they could be able to fix it, they do it with the help of the municipality, of the help with the enterprise of the government. They are discussing about water. When they are discussing about water, they have to discuss about health and water. But that is already organized. You have to organize the society in order that you could be able to have opportunity to take those issues in consideration. For example, talking about agriculture, we make a survey, and we knew this year that there are around more than 3,000 small farmer, medium and small farmer, that are doing agroecology. Those people that are doing agroecology, they are working with the same objective.
And what do you mean by agroecology?
Agroecology is a science that holds all of the technique, the activities and technique of sustainable agriculture. It's a new science that is going to substitute the old paradigm related to the Green Revolution, okay? So agroecology for us is a science that has taken in consideration the relation of the social and economic issue in the community, looking the design, the evolution of the productive process in the community, taking in consideration the social and cultural values of the community. For example, we don't believe it that you could be able to do agroecology if the community is not participating in that topics, okay?
And we've seen a lot of this in the third world as a result of the Green Revolution, where water tables were diminished, where people's existing knowledge about land use wasn't incorporated, and we have devastation because of it, right?
Right, this is true. So I use an example. I give you the example of water table that are in the community councils, as a project of the community council, and the working that I doing, you know, in order to know how the water is coming, how we could be able to preserve the water. Besides the water, we have emissions, that trees mission, and we have several missions in the process, in the revolutionary process, where another community council are dealing to growth, to sow and grow trees in order that we could be able to produce water. So it's a relationship in the process that you are building, okay? When we are talking about agroecology, what you say, how we could be able to say to the poor people, to say to the people, to the grassroots level, okay, those people that are working in agroecology, they are working from the same objective. They are working, several farmers are working in the same space. They are doing in a very interesting relationship. They are being a social responsibility for the activities they are doing. So they are doing just public policy because they are building their own agenda. And that agenda that is coming from the bottom to the top is in front of the agenda of the government. So the government has to start to switch the agenda and try to get together with the agenda of the small farmer. And that one happened in Venezuela. That situation is happening in Venezuela. After those farmers start with the agroecological activity, going in the transition process, and such in figures that I have here, figures that are really significant for us, but probably for the production of the United States are not significant, okay? Those people make so much pressure that the government start to give some agroecological credits in order that they could be able to get money and buy input to the productive system in order to do agroecology. That one is a pretty good example. Pretty good example in the way that how you could be able to put in the table the issue of the food process, the issue of the food policy. And that one is the reason why we are putting in the table to discuss the new vision of food sovereignty. Like I told you before, we cannot see food sovereignty if we don't take in consideration agroecology. But also, we're talking more about many social issues that are going on in Venezuela. For example, the health. We have short of medical doctors in Venezuela. And we receive the unique help of the medical Cuban. There are around 9,000 medical Cuban in Venezuela. What are they doing? They are going to the poor neighbor and they're establishing places where they could receive the people and taking care. But those places that we call consultorios, multi-propósitos, like we say, multi-purpose healthcare system, those spaces are spaces in order that they could be able to teach people that want to be involved in a huge important program in a health system that is going to form, that is going to create the community medical doctor in the community. That career, that field takes you 6 years. And you are dealing with a new type of education because the student, which there are right now 23,000 medical community students, 23,000 medical community students. And 70% of the 23,000 medical community students are women. So they receive their class in their own municipality, in their own community council, and they receive teaching theory lesson, but also they receive a practice. Next year, we are going to have the satellite that is buying to China. We are going to receive classes. Those people are going to receive classes
by satellite,
right? So we are looking for a new paradigm from the educational point of view. And that one has to deal with the revolution. And that one, when we're talking about, for example, how we could be able to teach agroecology or how we could be able to change the curriculum in the agricultural school. Okay, we are giving to the student several questions about agricultural problems and see if the education that are you gaining in your university will solve the technical problems that are related with the field. That one is another way to see the educational process. That one is another way how you could be able to build a curriculum, to build a pensum, to get together courses, knowledge, to recognize the knowledge of the peasant, to put in the table, because we have to learn so much from them. I am giving you some unique examples about what we are doing in Venezuela.
I want to remind listeners that I'm speaking with Miguel Angel Nunez. He's visiting from Venezuela, and he's an advisor to the Venezuelan Presidential Office on agro-environmental issues, and he's also the former coordinator of the Latin American Agroecological Movement. A lot of what I hear you talking about really makes me want to bring up this topic about who does science serve, right? Because we've been talking about health, we've been talking about land use, we've been talking about agriculture. I'm curious how multinationals that have already been in Venezuela, how they're receiving this, if they have any way that they're incorporating any of this into their existing models.
Well, okay. That one is not that easy answer, but I am trying to answer in this way. The multinational companies, they have really clearly, from the political point of view, what they want to do in business in everywhere of the world, not only in Venezuela. According to our constitution, we have several type of economic dynamics in Venezuela. We have the national economy that have to deal with all of the process that the Venezuela government does, national park, oils, natural resources, water. We have a mixed economy that have to do with private enterprise and also sharing with the government. We have multinational enterprise that are working directly in the government. And we have the space that we are building to try to build the social economy. The multinational depend in one way to do science and to do technology. And so far, we see in the Venezuelan process that the science and the technology that we are doing a science that doesn't have conscience. And we are doing some technology that doesn't have social belonging, social responsibility. So right now, when you are organizing several type of socialist enterprise, like in aluminium, like in iron, like in petrochemical, like in agriculture, we will ask a question. What kind of design and technology do you want to develop those enterprise? When we're talking about what kind of design and technology, we have to discuss with the multinationals and transnational company what kind of science we want also to share with them, and we can design, we are to belong, we are to permit they do it in the country. When we're talking about what kind of science do you want for your country, we must discuss what kind of education, the higher education, we should be able to have our country. Because you won't give a science, you won't give formation of the science if you don't have an education. You have to talk about education. Right now in Venezuela, we're trying to articulate it, those aspects. We want, for example, that the project of the industrial ministry, all of the project that industrial ministry will be very close related with the project that is financial, the Ministry of Science and Technology, because it doesn't have any sense that comes from people and financial a project that doesn't belong, that doesn't have to do with the social responsibility, with social pertinence. Transnational companies someday will ask about what we are going to be helping the people, especially with the food issue, because right now the people is starting to realize how important is the food issue in our health. The people, Laura, are understanding that they know if they feed really well their family, they will have less opportunity to get sick. And the transnational companies, the food transnational company with all of the additive and all of the transformation and such, what they gave is not only food. They gave food to get sick, to get disease. So it's a process. It is a process that you don't know how long, how fast that process will be going. But for example, if you have a country that having in their constitution the right to be really well fed, I think it is a very important step for another society. For example, right now in Ecuador, who is coming a new constitution, well, you know, they are discussing right now how to put sustainable agriculture in the constitution. In Bolivia, the reality of Bolivia is very complex due to the fact that you have pluricultural ethnic groups. They are discussing about to put in the constitution sustainable agriculture. And that will give to the population of Bolivia, the population of Ecuador, something to thinking about. If you put that idea to discuss with the people will pick it up soon, that idea, and start to move and start to be thinking different and acting different.
What about the larger Latin American picture? Because I know that when I go back home to Argentina, you fly over the south of Brazil and the north of Argentina and you just see green and it's so beautiful. And you're like, wow, look at all this amazing, you know, fertile land that we have here. The reality behind that, though, is that most of that is genetically modified and it's for export, right? And at the same time, people in Argentina, people in Brazil are dying of hunger. It's this total paradox. Mm-hmm. So how does what's happening in Venezuela in terms of not food security, but you say food sovereignty, how is that informing other nearby countries?
Okay. Well, we are trying to pick it up. Different type of relationship between different type of government, for example, from the Venezuela government, and try to be involved in the food issue with different type of perspective and different type of process. For example, last July, some Bolivian small farmer of soy who are working in Santa Cruz department, and they are producing soy without transgenic. They are producing soy in sustainable, responsible way. They are selling to Venezuela 80 tons of soy. And those small producers of soy are offering the technology to the Venezuela government to try to put that technology that called sustainable responsibility way to produce soy, even with test, traceability test, in front of the technology that some big enterprise that are struggling, you know, many peasants down in Uruguay, in Paraguay, in Argentina, in Brazil, want to sell to Venezuela. For example, here is the enterprise of the big fellows, big technology of the big economic groups down in Argentina that are selling to the technology to Venezuela. And we have the small farmer that are selling the technology to Venezuela. That contradiction is facing in Venezuela.
So it's like a Bolivarian model versus a free trade, so-called free trade model.
Right, right. But the important thing here, Laura, is that that discussion is on the table. And President Chavez must face that contradiction soon. And he has to face the contradiction if he keep model working with Green Revolution or if he's go to agroecology. And he has a pressure. And we are building that social pressure. And that one is very important, you know, that one president has to be involved in those issues. Like you say right now, the president of the United States barely mentioned about global warming. And there are many presidents down in Latin America that have very important issues to put in the table. For example, Correa in Ecuador is putting in the table the meaningful of the social economy. And Correa came out from the Chicago Boys, from Illinois. And you could imagine that we could be able to spread around another type of economy that could be able to be fixed in our own countries. That one makes difference. And that one makes changes. At least we are putting that one in the table. Now we are coming to build the University of the South, the Bank of the South, who is going to be dealing, not making the mistake that the World Bank and the IMF did it. Because we have the right opportunity to have our own bank. We have the right opportunity to have our own university. In other words, I would say very simple. You have your house. You want to build your home. You want your house. And you want to do your house in the way that you want to do it. You could accept advice of your house, but you're going to decide how you're going to be painting your house. How are you going to organize your house? How are you going to put your furniture in your house? This is the thing that we want to do in our country. All around Latin American countries are raising. The people are raising. The conscience is going up. And that one won't be nothing to stop it. It's going to be really difficult to stop the conscience of the Latin American population. It's coming around. And it's coming around many alternative propositions of the social movement that are putting in the table to have a better world. That one is the point that happened in Venezuela and many Latin American countries.
I want to move on and talk about biofuels, because this is something that, especially in the United States, especially in the last year or two, again, with people starting to use this buzzword of global warming, is often presented as a solution. And it sounds great, biofuels, and it's not gasoline, but there's kind of a whole other story going on behind that. Can you talk to us a little bit about biofuels?
Well, okay, so we are not agree with the biofuel for several reasons, you know. I don't have exactly figures from the energy, the expenditure, the rentability, the efficiency of biofuel. But one thing that we have to take in consideration is that the productive system of biofuel totally diminishing. The biofuel is coming from the Green Revolution. And the Green Revolution, we don't have an alternative. We don't have any very good answer, you know, not only for the distribution of the food and also for the production of the food. So biofuel are holding a productive model depending on the use of agrochemical. depending on the use of transgenic, depending on use of land devastating, depending on use of diminishing the water to use for irrigation. So if you're taking in consideration all of that process, productive process, and put in number, you will see that is unsustainable, the biofuel.
Not just when it's genetically modified either, right? Because even non-genetically modified sugarcane, it's kind of wreaking havoc on land. Right?
Yeah, I mean, but who knows that canned sugar is not coming like genetic. Mm-hmm. When we're talking about genetically modified food, always we have to see the rentability of genetically modified food. And I take you the consideration of the example that I put it before between the bigger enterprise producer of soya down in the south, in Argentina, such and such, and the small producer. The big enterprise, in order that the soya could be rentable, could be profitable, they have to grow more than 250 acres. 250 acres. In order that they won't get loss, economic loss. The small farmer don't need to do that one. So that one is not profitable, you know, it's not rentable. So that one is the point about biofuel. And besides that biofuel, we have an ethic problem that deals with the consumer society. You cannot establish social priorities in order to feed cars rather than feed people. So we need to feed first people. We need to give food security to feed the people with really good and health food, not to feed car, even though that we could be able to use all of the residue that are you using the production in order to produce biofuel. That one is the idea. But why we want to keep going feeding cars? Why we want to produce more car? For who? Who are the benefits? Who's going to have the benefit of feeding the car? And who's going to have the benefit producing the biofuel? So that one is a contradiction, you know, down in Latin America, especially in Brazil, because Brazil is going to be leading the production of biofuel. And it's going to be a contradiction among other Latin American countries. Because we are taking in consideration to use a percentage of biofuel in order to give some efficiency to the gasoline. But that one is not the point that are you looking here in the United States and are looking here in Brazil.
We've been speaking with Miguel Angel Nunez. Nunez is an advisor to the Venezuelan Presidential Office on Agroenvironmental Issues and the former coordinator of the Latin American Agroecological Movement. And for Uprising's subversive thought of the day, I'd like to quote Vandana Shiva, who once said, "Cultivating and conserving diversity is no luxury in our times. It is a survival imperative." That's Vandana Shiva, and it's Uprising's subversive thought of the day. You have been listening to Uprising. Our producer is Gabriel San Roman. We had engineering help from Tamika Zogi and Teddy Robinson. You can hear a podcast, listen to an audio stream, or download an MP3 of today's program at our website, www.uprisingradio.org. Just click on Weekly Programs. And you can email us at mail@uprising.org. To order a CD of today's program, go to pacificaradioarchives.org or call 1-800-735-0230. Sitting in for Sonali Kulhatkar, I'm your host and producer, Aura Bogado. Thanks for listening, and tune in next week for another edition of Uprising.